All right. Hello and again, welcome everybody to this session. My name is Monica Ramirez Andriada and I'm at the University of Arizona. I'm in the Department of Soil, Water, and Environmental Science with a joint appointment in public health. My training is mixed, so I'm a transdisciplinary researcher, have an ecology background, environmental science, policy, and an art degree. And so I'm thankful for all of you to be here, and I'm excited to share my research program and approach to community engagement and participatory approaches. So this hopefully is not new to you today, but the idea is that we need to recognize and fully embrace the notion that our zip code is more important and can be more important than our area code, than our genetic code. My whole major point. Okay, your zip code can be more important than your genetic code. That's what I need to make sure you get. So that where you live, what you look like, and how much money you make is going to depict your health outcomes much more than the genetic material that you are born with. And once you embrace and understand this, you can see how critical it is to work with and develop partnerships with communities that live in compromised spaces because of this statistic and this outcome and this state of environmental health in the world. So when I was working through and thinking about how do you truly do good work with communities that are neighboring waste, and when you're working, especially in federal Superfund sites, you have a lot of different stakeholder groups. You have local, state, federal government representation, you have the community, you have the affected community, you have the local town government, and so there's all of these people that are working in that space. And so how do you effectively work together? And so I developed a model called environmental research translation. Right, research translation has been around for quite some time, and this was my take on how do we develop a way to truly work holistically in these spaces. And so you would begin with a transdisciplinary team, which I'll describe, effective collaboration, ensuring that you have information transfer, public participation, and then when you're communicating data, that you're using a cultural model of risk communication. So for the sake of today, I'll focus on these two. So there's three, if we were to classify the types of research that occur, we have multidisciplinary research. That's where you have there are disciplines working on the same question, but they're isolated, right? So you might be asking the same question, but you're not necessarily cross-pollinating and you're working within your own disciplinary boundary. With interdisciplinary work, you're still working in your own disciplinary boundary, but you do attempt to integrate the data and the information to create a solution or to better understand the situation or problem at hand. What I'm advocating and presenting to you today is transdisciplinary research. That it has nothing to do with the discipline. It's not about you, it's not about your field, it's about the issue at hand. And so you bring people together based upon what you need to successfully solve the problem. In this case, you could see by our previous speaker who started to elucidate and tap upon the idea that for her to do the work, right, she really needed to have her science, she needed to connect with families, NGOs, understand and build momentum within communities and beyond her discipline as a scientist. And so I would ask you all to think about what it would mean to collaborate beyond those who do similar work as you, but then also beyond academia, and to consider what that means in terms of creating true long-term sustainable solutions. The other thing that falls under public participation in scientific research actually is a form of informal science education. And what that means is just science learning that people experience across their lifespan outside of school. So anything that you learn that's outside of school is called informal science education. But there's two major things that are important when you're recognizing and looking at informal science education. It's driven by the needs and interests of the learner, rather than an external authority. And that lifelong learning is intrinsically motivated, right? So the interest comes from within. It's not external pressure that makes you learn something, and that your learning is under the choice. That the learning is under the control of the learner. And so research has been done that actually shows that adult informal learning experiences contribute more to the variance in adult science knowledge than their schooling and childhood experiences. So when you're thinking about science education for people and for in this case adults, we have to think about capturing and capitalizing on these informal spaces. So even further, research suggests that nearly half of the public's science learning and understanding and learning derives from free choice. And even in a study done on the West Coast, 74 respondents attributed some or a lot of their learning to life experiences, followed by books and magazines, not for school. And so this is an area that we can utilize and work within to increase environmental education, environmental health literacy. So we know within society we have like an aquarium, a science technology center, we have museums, astronomy, but we have places where you can go look at through telescopes, planetariums was the word. Like you can go. But there truly isn't a designated infrastructure for environmental health, particularly for discussing the fate in transport, exposure, risk, and the challenges associated with developing the relationship between exposure and a health outcome. And so I would advocate today also is that these topics make environmental education and free choice learning especially important to communities neighboring hazardous waste, pollution, and resource extraction. So to guide the next slides throughout my talk is to give you these definitions. So public participation in scientific research, or what we've been calling citizen science, is these intentional collaborations in which members of the public engage in the process of research to generate new science-based knowledge. So that's critical to understand that it's intentional collaboration. Peer education, which I'll also show you some case studies, is where you engage and train those who share similar social backgrounds or life experiences, are teaching and sharing information with their peers. And then information design is about the idea of presenting information in a way that fosters efficient and effective understanding of the material so that the person can actually use it to make decisions. I briefly introduced public participation in scientific research, PPSR, but what I want to hone in on and make sure people recognize here is that they're varying types. So here are some examples I might highlight today, but members of the public could engage in a contractual agreement with the scientist, which means that they come to you and they say, I need help answering this question, can you do this work for me, right? But then you could see as it goes along that you'll go to contributory, where that's where a participant might collect data and send it to a scientist. We see this with the birding, a lab of ornithology has birding projects and whatnot. Collaborative is where you members of the public will contribute data, but they may also help refine the project, analyze. Co-created is they're active in all or most of the steps of the scientific method. And then at the end, it's collegial, where they don't even ask you, they're doing their work on their own, right? And so to highlight some examples here, you see, Galaxy Zoo is where the Hubble telescope took hundreds of thousands of images of the sky, of the universe, and realized that they didn't have enough time to actually go through it all. So what they did is they created an online tool to teach users how to identify galaxies. And so you can have your eye trained through this like online tutorial, learn how to identify galaxies, and then run through a bunch of images. And this is actually the way that they've gone through to identify different galaxies throughout the universe. And so you had a high school teacher in the Midwest get to be a co-author in like a high impact journal for astronomy and physics because she identified a galaxy through that Galaxy Zoo. But I'll also highlight like the Louisiana Bucket Brigade, where community members were smelling and were questioning whether they are being exposed to industrial pollutants from neighboring waste and industrial activity, and they set up their own buckets to collect air to do air sampling. And at the very end, you can see that I have Lois Gibbs, who was from Love Canal, under contractual as well as collegial, because she asked public health officials to do a study, but then she collected data on her own through community mapping to actually identify that there were families that were suffering and children in her neighborhood that were born with malfunctions and health issues. And so she did multiple approaches. So participants are motivated from a variety of things. They want to contribute to science, they want to protect their livelihoods and satisfy personal learning goals. And the outcomes of this type of work are outstanding. We can see advances in science, right? You have hundreds of thousands of people like monitoring birds and monarch butterflies. You have hundreds of thousands of people looking at the flower dates of certain flowers and areas to do inform phenology. So we've seen advances in our understanding of the ecological world. At the individual level, participants report that they increase their understanding of the scientific method, literacy, ownership of knowledge and expertise. And then what we call the socio-ecological state is where you can see people using the information for action, developing relationships, and impacting legislation. And so we see increases in access and use of data, in participant engagement in policy, and also rapid detection of environmental problems. So I highlight here today that most environmental justice projects actually start with the green, right? They want to see change, action, legislational change, or changes in policy, and build relationships to change the environment, like their environmental health. And so we should recognize that, right? And then they see that PPSR is the approach that should be used. And we should look at how social learning processes, right, embedding and collaborating can contribute to more resilient socio-ecological systems. So if you're doing public participatory approaches, you're actually building social cohesion and allowing and building resiliency, but I would say human capacity in those spaces. So I'm from Arizona, and this is what it looks like. We have a ton of resource extraction activities within our space. We have a confluence of environmental issues. We can see here in the upper, which would be for you guys, the upper left, this is the mine workers, so how many people are employed by mines. You can see it within the Arizona, we have quite a bit. If you go down, you can see that we have arsenic, these hotspots of arsenic in soils, which could be naturally occurring, but also aggravated by mining activities. We have low precipitation, and we also have several areas where we where we're not meeting, or we're exceeding the Clean Air Act standard for particulate matter at 10 microns or below. And actually we have red and yellow, which is red is considered serious. But this idea is that we know that exceedance will impact human health. And so this is a confluence of issues that are going on within the state of Arizona. And so one project that I'll just to give you more of a story, I started out doing garden roots in one small mining community, which was a Superfund site. And here, community members at the very first community meeting in 2008 asked me, are my soils safe? Is it safe for me to consume vegetables from my garden? And if I can grow them, how much can I eat? And I was like, well, I don't have a site-specific answer, but if you want to work together on that, we can. And so it took about 2 years to build trust, build partnerships, and to get funding for this. I gave general guidance on how I trained all the community members who wanted to do the project, trained about 53 community members, and they went out and collected soil, water, and plant samples from their home gardens. Participants decided where to take soil samples and which vegetables to analyze. So this was me releasing power, right? It would have been great to give them seeds and have every single person grow the same exact thing so I could compare across. But it was more about them, right? It was what were foods that were culturally relevant to them? What do they eat? What do their kids eat? And so they submitted the samples that they consumed the most of. I'm not going to go into great detail. This is just showing the average daily dose of arsenic from the garden soil, homegrown vegetables, and water. And so you could see that their original question was dominated about vegetables and garden spaces. But when you look at this, it's actually it was water, soil, then homegrown vegetables. You can see that when a family, right here, you can see that when someone had incredibly elevated arsenic levels in their soil, that contribute that as well as, and the plants accumulated a little bit more of that arsenic, that the incidental soil ingestion and plant consumption actually contributed almost 80% of their relative arsenic for that day, right? But overall, it was mainly from water. And so this was an important thing to touch base, have a community meeting, and let people know, hey, like we need to, if you have limited resources, let's address your water, talk about soil, and then we'll talk about what plants you can grow that accumulate less arsenic than others. The other big thing that was done here is explaining how exposure assessments are done so they can build capacity to work with regulatory agencies. This is a Superfund site, so it's really important that they understand how cleanup numbers come about. And it's through something like this, right? You have the concentration in the media, by intake, bioavailability, time, and lifetime over body weight. And so what was exciting during community gatherings, and so I trained 53 people, 25 people submitted kits, and then at the community meeting, 65 people showed up. So they brought their family and everybody. And what was awesome about that experience was the sharing of data, is that people actually recalculated their exposure that suited their lifestyle. And so it was like this unveiling of what exposure science is and what you use to do risk assessment actually was built a tremendous amount of capacity, because someone would say, there's no way I'm eating radishes every day, right? So people could see how that worked out. And so building on the successes of Garden Roots and Dewey Humboldt and a recent needs assessment with Extension and rural gardeners, I launched Garden Roots like at the universal scale, right, in 2015 to evaluate environmental quality in rural residential community gardens. And so I asked people throughout my, at large gardening meetings and talking to Extension agents across the state, and they said, do you have any concerns, right, about when you're gardening? And you can see here the contamination, environmental quality, and conservation. There were concerns. And this gave me gave me data that more people beyond Dewey Humboldt, beyond that small rural mining town, have the same questions because of how much resource extraction activities occur within the within Arizona. And so here was where Garden Roots was launched. You can see everything's color-coded. This is all intentional, right, so that people can see the personalization of their site, right? Oh, I'm Greenlee County, I'm green, I'm Cochise, I'm purple, right? So when they would navigate through the website, they can move through with color. And launching Garden Roots at the state level, I trained 93 community members, received 56 kits back, which totaled up to 125 soil samples, 174 water, and 267 plant samples. And so what does this methodology look like? Okay, so I'm going to take you through what I do, what Garden Roots is, right? So the first thing is participant training. This is where myself and my students, we go out into those mining communities and we train the participants, right? So here you can see how do you collect the soil sample, and then you can see the participants collect, and then the plants get, this is using plants as an example, what it goes through. But this was critical to share with participants. This whole process of like, I'm gonna train you, you're gonna collect, and once you submit, look what has to happen. Because this takes a while, right? So one common thing in these public participatory projects is community members are like, oh, what's taking them so long, right? So you just share with them what takes so long, right? In this case, so regular contact, managing expectations, and explaining the process is critical. So if you were a participant in Garden Roots, you would get a postcard, right, that would move through the process. And so the participant would get a postcard, and it would, as it moved, you'd say, we're here. So you knew where we were in this whole entire process. So for the sake of the rest of the discussion today, I'll focus on translating the results in community gatherings. And so what happened? So I held 5 different community gatherings. So I had the data, analyzed it, and launched community meetings and gatherings in each community. As I stated, I have an art background. I have a Master of Fine Arts student, and together we designed result booklets. So when you're reporting this data back, so this is a critical component of participatory approaches, right? If you're asking people to go out and collect samples and to be part of the research, but then you don't share the data, what's the gain for them? You could give them a target card, but a lot of times, since they're intrinsically motivated, they want their data, right? And so components of this report back booklet, there was a letter explaining the project, thanking them, important terms, or you could call it glossary, project overview, and then the results were divided into 3 sections, water, soil, plant. Then there was general information on selected contaminants of concern, which essentially was a mini encyclopedia, references and solution and exposure reduction methods. This right here is incredibly critical. If you're going to share the data and tell them like what you observed in their samples, you need to tell them how to mitigate that exposure. Even if the science, even if it's like for people who are doing emerging pollutants, this is tricky because we don't actually have definitive answers between exposure and health outcomes. But we do know in general, if you want to reduce your phthalate exposure, avoid some plastics, right? So you would say that. I didn't do phthalates here, but that was an example. Okay, so trying to use a different and new way of reporting data back. So we tried looking at making these like mountain topography type of layouts. And so you could see here that the red represents Arizona soil remediation levels. These are levels that are that could trigger cleanup. And so these were the what we used, so state specific. Then you can see that your level or the participant's level was represented in green. And then other samples in the area are represented by this grayish grayish color. And so what they saw was all of their, everyone's data together in comparison to these remediation standards. And if you had an exceedance, you would have the peak of that mountain circled, and we would go into more detail. And if there was trouble with the reading of the graph, you can see here that we had them all listed out as well. As I stated, presenting solutions is critical, so I designed and put together safe consumption of homegrown vegetables, how to prepare a garden, and safe gardening practices to mitigate incidental soil ingestion. And so this was talking about how you can actually amend your soils to reduce the accumulation of lead and arsenic into the edible tissues, as well as how can you be a safe gardener, keeping your gardening shoes and clothes outside, washing all your vegetables with a vegetable brush, right, rigorously washing your fruits and vegetables. So, how did it go? So this was a large, gardener, it's this, like you saw, 267 plant samples, three major, pretty large counties. And so what happened, right? So we held focus groups. When we did these community gatherings, we held focus groups, and we wanted to make sure we understood why people were participating in Garden Roots. And so you can see here, reasons for participation primarily found under concern for health, followed by education and evaluating the health of and growing foods, excuse me. So one participant stated that I've been connected to health my whole life, so it was very much a health thing. Another was interested in the information they received, saying, for me, it's a desire to learn. I enjoy information. I'm highlighting specific things here because it was a focus group. So here we were asking and trying to get a sense of efficacy. Like, did they feel like they had a more sense of control or that they could take action in their community based on doing the project? And so, do you feel like you could see how you were contributing to the study? So we had 10 respondents out of 17 agree that what, or state, not agree, agreed with that they could see their participation, and they said, with accumulating information, we can see our impact in one area. We also were excited to see how people felt like they would be more involved in environmental action in their community, and then they were capable of change. And so it was these were really exciting outcomes to see. Those who responded, some participants commented that they saw the power of people working together and felt better equipped to go out in their community as they were capable of, because they had concrete information to show them. In addition, all respondents said that they felt capable of creating change in their communities. And so, and then we're asking, would you do another one? Somebody had already signed up. So it was great to start to elucidate what do people gain after being in this project. And now it's really about the long-term follow-up of what actual activities and actions did they take. The other side of things was the functionality of the booklet, right? So how well did it work for someone to navigate through? And so here's just a general layout of what one might experience. And so we saw that most of the participants stated that the design was functional and that they could find information they were seeking in the booklet. Participants commented that the booklet was visually appealing, easy to understand, well-organized, and they appreciated the fact that the booklet began with the results for water, which they believed to be the most important information. And actually, some people reported nice paperweight and quality. So they actually enjoyed holding and working through the results booklet, which is quite important if you're trying to create this experience beyond just the sampling. And so although the majority of the participants enjoyed the design and functionality, many expressed that it contained a lot of information they would need additional time to look over and digest before fully comprehending the material. So one participant stated, I'm definitely going to take the result booklet home and look at it in much more detail and share it with my husband and my friends. And so that was good feedback, what might have happened is this encyclopedia and overview of all these pollutants they wanted to make sure they have might have just made it too heavy and too much. But they were going to go share it with others in their family, which was a good sign. Another concern or something that was raised was that the doing the logarithmic scale was a little tricky for them to work through. So for the last, I have about 4 or 5 minutes left, and I'm going to stop there. I have another case study, but I think it'd be, this is looking at working with community health workers. And so this is a whole nother design of participatory approach where it wasn't me training families in each community. It's about me training community health workers. So they went through a 40-hour training, and then they go out and train their community members. And so we have this papers in review, actually in review right now, where we are able to see statistically significant differences in efficacy for science and environmental action. And we saw this at the community health worker level as well as the home level. So the community health workers would go out into communities and visit homes, sit down with them, discuss this material, and we saw a significance in learning and efficacy in both the health worker and the person who got the resident of the home. So my concluding slides would be that it's critical to consider the steps in research and work alongside community members, and that you can just generically take these steps and think about at what point or where communities or those you are engaged can work, where you can work together on these efforts. And so I would say that it's important to do research translation, democratize science, and have peer education. Thanks. Oh. That's a whole nother thing. Yeah.
Thank you for the interesting talk. What happens with these sites that have innovated arsenic levels and exceeded thresholds, and are they owned by the people who took these methods?
Yeah, so in the first version of Garden Roots that was done in Dewey Humboldt, that was, most of them were homeowners, majority of them owned the land. And so one thing that's important is they looked at native soils where they weren't growing any food and that was not amended, and their garden. And so most of the time there, and so we were able to compare, you know, how much the amendment assisted and whether it like reduced or elevated. In some cases we saw elevated, like the arsenic concentration go up due to what they're amending with, which is a whole other conversation. But what happened to them is that they had their data and they knew that now they were either going to, you know, avoid or do something differently with their garden space. So one community, that one that had the high, it was like over 300 milligrams per kilogram arsenic in their soils, they pretty much did a whole excavation. They just got rid of it. Another home where the arsenic in their well water exceeded 1,000 micrograms per liter. And so that was where I actually sat down and worked with that family to get them on the water, the public water supply. Because in that case, we had some issues with the public water supply, but that's, I can talk to you about that later. Yeah? Yeah, so in this case, in Dewey Humboldt, it was the Superfund site has elevated levels of arsenic and lead, but surprisingly in the soils, there were very few exceedances of lead over the 400 milligrams per kilogram, whereas arsenic was continually going above the Arizona soil residential screening level.
And how did you plant vegetables? Did you plant tissues for heavy metals?
That's correct.